Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Well, it's time to talk climate and weather. We're keeping our science theme here today on the weather, guys. It's obviously the last Monday of the month. And Steve Ackerman and John Martin are back with us. Steve is the former vice chancellor for research and graduate education at UW-Madison, emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve, good to have you with us.
It's great to be here and glad to hear you put weather and science together.
John Martin, our other weather guy, professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison as well. John, good to see you.
Good to see you, Larry.
As we talk with them, I hope you'll join in the conversation. Give us your latest weather experience, or maybe you've got a question, or maybe you have a weather photo. We'd love to have you send your interesting weather photos to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Of course, you can always ask a question as you email it in. But you can also call us. We'd love that, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. Well, let's start about September, talking about September. There was a warm September. Last week was the autumnal equinox. We talked about that a little bit with Bassam Shakashiri. September ends tomorrow. Cool temperatures are usually the norm. We're getting to be the norm this time of the year, but what's happening? It's 80s.
Yeah, I don't know if it's the norm. I mean, looking at this for last week's newspaper column, we've had multiple Septembers where temperatures have been above 80. It's rare to find one that doesn't have a few temperatures above 80, as it turns out. However, when you get to this point in the year, we're about at the climatologically, that is long-term average, last 80-degree day. I think it's either today, tomorrow, or Wednesday, somewhere right around the 1st of October. However, last year, the last 80-degree day set a record on October 29th. So it's conceivable we still have a month left of visitations by 80 Fahrenheit or higher. And honestly, I don't see any reason not to expect that over the next 10 days. We're going to have several between now and then.
And it just doesn't fit with October weather.
I know.
No. For me, my personal experience, I want to see the cool weather and the leaves changing.
Some of them are just drying right up and falling off. Yeah, you know, the ones that still are on the trees are largely green, I'll grant you, but there's a whole bunch in the gutter that are dried up. So they're falling somewhat stealthily as they dry out, because it's been dry, too, over this period. So
it's not just the warm, it's the dry weather.
It seems like they can both conspire,
They're falling slowly, which is nice, because I can just run my mulching mower over them and I don't have to rake.
Yeah. I like that too. I like
been
that.
There, done that.
I love that.
Well, should we be worry or just enjoy the warmth?
I think we should be concerned. All right. I keep track of the Northern Hemisphere's change to the fall from fall into winter. And for the first 25 days of September, this year was the ninth warmest September in the Northern Hemisphere over that period of time since 1948, so out of 78 seasons. That's unusual. And all of the ones that are ahead of it, you know, from numbers 1 through 8, were in the last 10 years. This is not normal. Yeah. It's become the new normal, and the new normal is too warm, and it's bound to cause a lot of problems.
It's certainly the trend that we're seeing. The warming, global warming is real. We're seeing it no matter what some of our leaders say. And, this 80-degree weather, maybe we just start looking for November.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool weather time.
Yep.
Well, Jamie in Algoma has a weather-related question, so let's go there. Jamie, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm not sure if it's a weather-related question. We're wondering if it is. We noticed this weekend that when we tried to listen to WPR or last night WIXX for the Packers game, we couldn't get our radios to tune you in for anything. We found one radio that would work. We're listening on the app right now because it just won't come in. We're wondering if it could be related to sunspots or some atmospheric thing, or do you guys have any clue?
So,
I don't think there is some increase in solar activity, but I don't think it's going on right now with this particular day. That would also impact transmission of a radio signal. I don't know if they still do it. Run the signal off and bounce it off the ionosphere. Is that the way you typically?
I don't know.
We don't do it that way very much.
I guess in that case, you get better reception at certain times of the day. It tended to be the case in the old days. But Steve, I think you're exactly right. I mean, 50 years ago, there may have been a solar event that was causing disruptions for broadcast that we wouldn't know about. We weren't monitoring it. But now, there's no way you wouldn't hear that independently, that there's something going on, probably. Right. So I don't know what the answer might be.
Yeah.
Well, maybe somebody else has an idea. I know there's a difference on how the sound waves work between AM and FM.
Yeah.
No, that's true. That's good you have the app. I mean, I now listen to Wisconsin Public Radio when I work out. Turn the app on. It's just it's really amazing.
Well, maybe somebody else has some ideas on it too, Jamie. We'll keep listening and we'll see what we can come up with in addition to what we've already said. And you can join in, maybe have a comment on Jamie's experience, or maybe you have another question relating to weather or climate, and you can join in at 800-642-1234 or email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. On September 16th, I think it was, the Wisconsin State Climatology Office issued its latest report describing the past summer as wet, warm, and sticky, which is the scientific way to put it, I guess. It's the one that we all know.
I
assume they mean humidity-wise in terms of sticky.
So the summer, was the summer atypical in any way?
I think they hit it on all three counts. Yeah. It wasn't the warmest summer we've ever had. 1988 was probably in the last 50 years one of the warmer ones. But it was persistently muggy here, and I think that showed up in the statistics. The average dew point was higher over the course of this summer than it was in many recent summers. I forget what the next competitor was. We had a nice presentation in our department by Steve Avris, who's the director of the State Climatology Office, a couple of Fridays ago. And we also had that August 9th and 10th heavy rain event in the Milwaukee County region and across the southern part of the state, but especially Milwaukee County, which may have set the all-time single-day precipitation record for the state of Wisconsin. It's still being determined. A high school with a monitoring station just northwest of Milwaukee City itself had 14.95 inches of rain, I think, in a 24-hour period, which would break the old record if it stands up to the scrutiny by over almost 3 inches.
Wow.
So it's it's in another category entirely.
Yeah.
And the city itself that day had 9.5, I think, or something like that. So it was a remarkable rain event. So that was another feature of our recent summer. So it was unusual.
So those storms wring that moisture out of the atmosphere and bring it to the ground.
I mean, we walked home from the ball game that night to our car about a mile away, and we were hit by, you know, pigeon egg-sized raindrops, freshly melted hailstones. They were huge. They were the kind that come out of tropical storms.
Wow.
It was amazing.
Well, Vince in Burlington has something that may relate to this. I'm not sure. Vince, hi, what's on your mind?
Yes, good morning. In 25 words or less, can you describe the expected changes with the Gulf Stream and its impact on the weather in Europe?
Oh, on Europe. Mm. Oh.
Well, there's theories out there that seem now to be, it's going to be over 25 words. I got to give you a little preamble. Right. These theories seem to have been overstated, that the Gulf Stream can suddenly shut down. Were it to shut down suddenly, a transport of really warm water, enormous volumes of warm water to high latitudes, would drastically change the weather of northwestern Europe. It would make it a lot colder, probably a little drier, but a lot colder for sure. And more representative of being at 50 to 60 degrees latitude. Those people get away with murder in terms of temperature, given their latitude, because of the Gulf Stream. And if it suddenly shut down, it'd be a lot colder there.
Yeah.
But you don't see, there's nothing to suggest that it's going to shut down.
Well, there's plenty to suggest it could. It's just that I think that the most recent stuff we've heard in our department from scholars who travel through has been that maybe it's been a little bit exaggerated how quickly it could shut down. But one of the key things to driving the Gulf Stream and the importation poleward of that warm water is cooling making the water more salty in the far North Atlantic. And so if cold air outbreaks with dry cold air come over that the Labrador Sea, they can take water out by evaporation, make it saltier, and make it colder by contact with the cold air. If that shuts down, that's a big pump for the Gulf Stream. So as the planet warms, that's a risk.
Is sea ice melting in terms of putting fresh water over it?
Yeah,
as
that's
well,
right. Freshening it down, is also bad news. Yep. Because that's less dense water. It won't sink.
Right.
Vince, there you go. Thank you for calling. Charlie in Menominee, we'll turn to you. Thanks for calling, Charlie.
Yeah, I was listening to the lady who mentioned about not being able to pick up nearby radio or TV stations. But, you know, there's a thing called, I think it's called isotropic inversion or something like that. And it tends to happen, I think, when it's real in the summertime. Where I know that when I lived over in Door County, I couldn't pick up local Green Bay stations, but I was able to pick up a TV station out of Kitchener, Ontario. and so there is maps that I don't think I'm saying the right term, isotropic inversion or something like that. And there's maps that they put out to see how active it is, and if, you know, and rates the zones for you know your part of the part of the country. And if we're like at a level 9, that seemed like, oh, you're not going to get local stations, but you might be getting something 500-600 miles away.
Wow, that's weird.
So so I recommend she looks up, reasons why your radio signal wouldn't be coming in now, or you know, close by ones, but far away ones are. And this map would, you know, you'll get to that website.
Huh, interesting.
Yeah, okay. That's very cool.
I didn't know they were available so quickly.
Yeah, me either. Yeah, and I think if the word that you used isn't precise, we don't know either. But if it isn't the right exact word, it strikes me that it sounds a little bit like ionosphere or ionospheric or something like that. And that was Steve's comment. So
yeah,
there might be something going on in the upper part of the atmosphere that encourages this. Really interesting.
Yeah. Well, an isotropic inversion is a geophysical or mechanical modeling technique that assumes a material's properties are the same in all directions, which is then used to analyze data that may actually exhibit.
So it's the method to analyze the data.
Yeah,
sort of like when we do inversions. There's temperature inversions, but there's also inversion equating.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Charlie, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Rick in Elkhart Lake will give you a chance. Hi, Rick.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. You were talking about global warming before, and I thought I had read a couple days ago that China now produces at least 25% of their electricity from renewables, and cars, 50% of the cars that they sell are fully electric now. So I wonder if this might be some cause for celebration or some ray of hope. I realize the United States is getting left behind, but I was, if that's true, I was impressed with the progress that's been made.
Yeah, I read that 25% number as well. I didn't read the whole article, but it is a good sign, I think, considering how much energy they consume in particular.
Yeah. It's a bad sign, though, because we'll be trailing them.
Yes, by
you
lot.
Know, I'd much rather be exporting that technology than importing it at a premium. And that's where, you know, dropping the ball on purpose the way we've done recently is really horrible. It certainly doesn't make America first. It makes America second at best. And if China's first, then we're going to pay whatever China decides we're going to pay for the new energy revolution. So, yes, I agree. It's encouraging that this can be done. Well, why did it have to be proven overseas before we decided to have enough confidence to do it here? Yeah. It's ludicrous. But hopefully we can pick it up.
Steve Ackerman, John Martin, our weather guys, our guests today, and you can join in at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News as we visit with Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our weather guys from UW-Madison. It's great to have them back. And questions, join in at 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Let's go to Dean in Evergreen, Colorado. Hi, Dean.
Hey, guys. Hey, great as always to hear from you, and thanks for taking my question. By the way, I have to take exception to all this warm weather talk. We're sailors, and we were planning on taking our boat, our sailboat, up to Lake Superior to go sailing on it this fall, but or summer, late summer, I should say. But we had a problem with our rudder. Anyway, our friends from Pueblo did make it up there, and they endured some winter on Isle Royale the beginning of this month.
Oh, yeah. Beginning of the month was cold.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Heavy wind, too, so they were out in some pretty tough seas there. But anyway, and I should say, I think it's Steve that went from Boston and Wisconsin in search of winter.
No, that's me.
That's John.
Oh, John, yeah.
No, I wasn't searching for winter. I was just hoping I'd get a facsimile.
Yeah, well, you didn't go far enough west. We have snow here. In fact, the higher elevations got 6 to 8 inches up at the ski resorts this past week here in Colorado.
Oh, I didn't realize
it's
that.
It's always the same story, though, Dean. I was in Seattle for 8 years. Yeah, just go to the mountains. You'll get snow. Of course you will. I want to see it at sea level.
Well, you've got a question, though, I believe.
I'm getting to it. Yes, thank you. So my training is in meteorology, but I wandered off into micrometeorology. So I'm a little unfamiliar with what's evolved since the dawn of time when I went to undergraduate school. And so it's popular on the, or as far as I can access, are two models that you guys are quite familiar with. GFS, which is an American model, and ECMWF, which is a European model. And when I access those model outputs on the internet, I can get a forecast, I can understand. But is there more in that final analysis? When you see a weather model, for instance, is that a compilation of different analyses that are gathered into one final product? And I wonder that because I see these hurricane forecasts, which have spaghetti models output, and they say that comes out of these longer range forecasts.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. It's a good question. The forecast model is a computer-based tool that takes information, initial conditions, and then runs forward a simulation of the atmosphere and how it will behave in the near term, 0 to 3 days, sometimes longer than that. There's a lot of pre-processing of the collection of global data that goes into giving the model those initial conditions. And so that's one enormously important step, and it's called data assimilation. So we try to assimilate all the different platforms, all the different data sources that can come into informing the model about what might happen in the future. So the assimilation process is extraordinarily important. The European Center does a better job at that than we do in the United States, and there's no good reason for that. One of our colleagues in our department, Professor Michael Morgan, spent the last 2.5 years at NOAA in the Biden administration working on that very problem. And the U.S. weather bill that just passed a few weeks ago is making a huge incremental increase in our efforts in data assimilation. Because Michael told me that the actual computer code that runs the global forecast system model, the GFS you mentioned, Dean, gives a better forecast than the European Center model. Most people will say, wait a minute, no, that's not the popular story. But the European Center model does a better job as part of their assimilation. So if you take their assimilated data and run it through the GFS, you get a better forecast every time. So our modeling's better, but our assimilation's worse. But the other aspect that pertains to your question is you can run multiple simulations using the same initial conditions that you only slightly perturb, make them slightly different, and that's called an ensemble forecast. That's run routinely now for everyday weather, but it's especially highlighted when it comes time to forecasting the track and intensification history of an upcoming tropical cyclone. So they almost always go to an ensemble, and that gives you all the multiple lines on the so-called spaghetti plots that are possible solutions for what happens with that storm. That's now become routine.
So in the ensemble forecast where you're doing hurricane tracks, do they do it a lot more because we really don't have the data observations there and therefore they want to tweak it and play with it a little bit more?
That's a really good question, Steve. It's a combination that the data is insufficient, probably, as it always is when you're trying to model something in the atmosphere. The other thing is that the small-scale processes that you're trying to replicate in the model have to be parameterized. They have to be given a sort of a not quite precise calculation, something less than precise. And you want to try several different ways to do that less than precise calculation and see how that impacts the forecast.
Yeah.
So fooling around with the so-called parameterizations is another reason to have multiple solutions on a given forecast day that you want to see. I want to know what the range of a variable or variation is on this track or this intensity.
Interesting. Yeah, yeah, very interesting. Dean, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Mary in Madison, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Mary.
Hello. Yeah, I was wondering about case weather. I remember that, you know, years back. I'm 80 now. And I was wondering if anyone's tracking that.
Case weather.
Case when you put something up.
As somebody who...
tobacco, right?
Harvested and worked in tobacco fields when he was a young man, and that's how I made quite a bit of money late in the fall. Mm. And then again in around January, there's a time the tobacco leaves the tobacco plants are speared onto laths and hung to dry in tobacco sheds. Mm. And at some point, those tobacco plants need to be taken down and the leaves stripped off and put into bales. And material, the paper that was used were put in cases. And I don't know if that's why it's called case weather, but the thing about January is almost invariably you would get a more humid week. The humidity would go up, which would be infused into the leaves. Mm. And so when you were taking the leaves off the tobacco plant itself, they wouldn't crumble up.
Up.
Oh, yeah. Interesting.
And you would lay the leaves in the slot, and then when you get around 50 pounds or so, where when that particular case filled up, then you wrapped the paper around and tied it up. Uh-huh. And so case weather was weather at a time period when the humidity would go up after this long drying spell, which would have occurred September, October through till January.
Mm.
Typically January.
Yeah.
But about a week.
So I wonder if it's tied to the old and somewhat resonant in the statistics of a January thaw. You know, where it warms up a little bit, because the only way to get the humidity up is to warm the air up at that in the dead of winter. And we almost get always like a four or five or 6 day period, mid to late January, where the temperatures climb to 40 degrees, even if they've been hovering near zero for much of the winter. So it's interesting. I wonder if they're connected that way.
Well, I'm sure that any tobacco farmer would have known, when you'd be watching the weather and when you were going to get that higher humidity. And then you were out in the tobacco shed, the stripping shed, as they call it. You'd be stripping the tobacco leaves off the plant. Mm. And because they were now a little damper.
They wouldn't crumble.
They wouldn't crumble.
Yeah. Wow.
Mary, I don't know if we answered your question here.
I just heard November, when it's really foggy and warm.
Yeah,
and
it could be any month after the tobacco had sort of dried like a leaf on a tree dries, but then they become very brittle.
Yeah,
and so it could be November. Mm. I think my memory was always January was that time when that happened. Mm.
That's so interesting. So was the idea that you dried it out to get rid of all the water. You don't want to be selling people water in the leaves. And then it gets a little bit more just pliant because it gets humid on the surface.
Just gets a little more
pliant. How do you like that? That's so interesting. Yeah. So it could happen at any time. In a cold climate like ours, it could be November. You could have a warm
spell.
It could
be November as long as the leaves were
dry enough.
Dried out.
Yeah, okay. Oh, interesting.
So there you go, Mary. I remember making a fair amount of money during the tobacco harvest season. And I had neighbors, most of our neighbors had tobacco.
Wow, sounds interesting.
Stoughton and Cottage Grove area.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a lot of handwork.
Yeah, I imagine it's tough work.
Thank you again for calling. You can join in, too. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Dave in Appleton, we'll go to you. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. So we vacation in Gulf Shores, Alabama, January and February. And although it's not a really hot time to go, we can always say at least the white stuff is sand on the beaches. Except for last year we got 9 inches of snow, and the last notable snow event, I think, was in 1993, and they were building snowmen on the beaches. They didn't have any shovels. Everything's closed down for days. What's up with that, and when do we expect the next one?
They are rare down that far south. Famous events like the one you're talking about occurred in 1895. Was a really tremendous freeze in early February of 1895 down the south. And there have been a few other ones, and you mentioned one from 93 was also noteworthy. But I'd say that the spacing between them is probably every 20 to 30 to 40 years. They're really unusual that far south, but they do occur. And it's just a function of, you know, how do all the tumblers in the lock line up that year? And you can get a really substantial cold air outbreak that really penetrates far southward. You got abundant moisture down there. It's not going to be hard to squeeze water vapor out of the air when you bring a weather system in there. You just got to have it cold enough to snow. And once in a while, it does.
Does that air just come out of Canada?
That comes straight out of Canada. It races straight down from the Central Plains, the prairie provinces, in cases like that. Yeah. Another famous one was 1780 in Charleston, South Carolina, in mid-February. I think that was when the British occupied the city during the Revolutionary War, and they lost a lot of men and equipment on piers that were kind of going out to the boats because they got overloaded with snow. They couldn't shovel it fast enough, so the piers broke.
Wow.
Imagine that.
Yeah. No, I can't.
Unbelievable.
You're a font of knowledge there.
When it comes to snow, I know a few things.
Dave, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Ed in Madison, we'll go to you. Hi, Ed.
Hi. I hope your learned guest might be able to advise me on the purchase of an aneroid barometer. I've been having bad luck with them. They don't seem to last more than 2 years. And I believe it's kind of a diaphragm affair, I believe, inside the barometer that measures the weight of air for the barometric pressure. And I don't know. I thought maybe it was perhaps because I mounted in the kitchen where it can be exposed to more smoke and humidity and gunk up that diaphragm. Or could it be just the fact that aneroids don't last long?
I don't think it's because you're in the kitchen, because, I mean, I have my weather station out on the dock, on our dock, and boy, it gets fog and smoke and everything out there. And the one thing that really seems to be solid is the pressure, the pressure gauge.
So what kind of gauge do you have?
You know, I'm running through my head what the brand name is, and I can't remember what it was because it's lasted so long.
Yeah, I don't know if it's Tempest. I just got one by Tempest as a gift.
Tempest.
I haven't mounted it yet, but I've heard good things about it. And then the other company I know makes really good meteorological instruments is Vaisala. They tend to be on the expensive side, but I don't know if that's what yours is.
Yeah, no, the Vaisala is too expensive for the dock. I already took one out with a boat once.
Oh, did you? you don't want to do that. You feel pretty bad about that. But they are really high-quality instruments.
Yeah.
And I don't know about lifetimes, but I bet probably longer than 2 years, yeah.
But
yeah.
That diaphragm, is that something that Ed was talking about?
It's diaphragm pretty standard technique.
It's pretty standard in everyone?
Yeah.
Device ILOR. The other way to do it was with a column of mercury, but
that's
you don't want to go that route
takes
these
a lot
days.
Of space. Yeah.
And the mercury is
you don't want mercury in your house. But I think Steve's point's good. I don't think that you probably have to worry too much about the humidity or any other pollution in your kitchen, you know, getting piling up on that. It's probably not the factor.
LaCrosse, that's the brand.
LaCrosse is a good one too, yeah. And they're kind of medium price, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and they're good. Yeah. They're also good.
So maybe consider LaCrosse, Ed. There you go. Thank you for calling. Vern in Boyd, Wisconsin. Your turn. Hi, Vern.
Yeah. So I calculated a great snowstorm of 1993 called the Storm of the Century. And I got it notarized. I got a big poster here. I call it the Gore Coal Disaster. It's actually notarized like in January 1993.
You remember that 93 storm? Vern's in Boyd, Wisconsin.
Oh, and it snowed in Boyd. Yeah. I don't think I remember that here in Madison, no. Oh, I wasn't here. It was the year before I came here. So
wasn't that the storm of the century?
That March of 93 was. The one that got 12 inches of snow in Birmingham and places like that.
Right.
More like the one that I think the other caller was talking about, the Gulf Shores or snow. So I don't know about this one from January of 93. Sorry, I don't know much about that one.
Yeah.
Or maybe Vern had the month wrong, too. It's been a long time ago.
Remember, it has been
January
or
March. It might have been the March one, Vern. Rich in La Crescent, your turn. Hi, Rich.
Yeah, I have a question about the wildfire smoke that we had this summer, which is almost every other day.
Mm.
Did it have the effect of making the air hotter because there was more things to absorb the heat, or did it make the air cooler because it reflected the sun's heat?
Hmm. Well, guessing. I'm not in the guessing.
It's a really good question.
Yeah,
as you're saying, during the day, it's going to reflect sunlight out, and that's going to tend to keep things cooler. It still has to be pretty dense, though, in order to have that cooling impact. During the night, you would think it would be like a cloud and keep temperatures warmer as it absorbs infrared radiation. But I don't think smoke particles are really as sensitive to the infrared radiation, for example, as clouds.
Mm.
So I don't think it has much of an impact on the nighttime temperature.
Yeah, and I know there's something in the climate science world that's one of the big puzzles known as the aerosol indirect effect. And does that involve how aerosols might seed clouds, actually produce clouds?
Yeah.
So the smoke particles probably have some ability to do that and enhance cloudiness a little bit and maybe undetectable to the naked eye, and in which case they become more radiatively important. But it's a really good question, and it gives an example of how it's difficult sometimes to know how will one phenomena impact the broad scale picture of your meteorology or your climate. There's a lot of different dimensions to most of these high-profile changes in the composition.
And I'm thinking the satellite imagery of those Canadian fire and the smoke that came down here were fantastic.
Yeah, amazing. It's right.
It looked like, you know, my parents used to smoke.
Yeah.
It looked like that blue cigarette smoke.
It really did.
It was
so
thick.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah. And I think this was the second worst Canadian wildfire year ever. And the worst one was 2024. So we had them back to back.
Yeah.
So incredible.
Rich, thank you again for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email a question or maybe a weather photo. We'll always love those. To talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller with the Weather Guys for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News as we talk climate and weather with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin from UW-Madison. Great to have them with us again today. A big thanks to everybody who donated during our fall member drive as well. Support from people like, Helen in Beloit or Rita in Madison make our service possible. And if you missed a member drive, still time to join in with your gift. Just go to WPR.org and you can make a contribution. It's been very uplifting for us here to see the support we've been getting. And I want to thank you so much for helping us keep WPR strong together. A big thanks to everybody who contribute, and you could still do it if you haven't done it already, WPR.org. We have Judy in Evansville emailed to ask, does the warm weather this fall, even at nighttime, have an effect on leaves turning color? Judy thought that a contrast in temperatures between day and night was needed to get good color, and I think that's the case.
Yeah. I think that is the case. If you want that nice color, you want those day-night temperature differences, which usually means you want nice, I always think of it as nice, clear skies during the daytime, because that means it'll be clear during night and it'll cool down.
And you got to have low dew points.
And you got to have low dew points, and you got to have low winds in order not to blow them off.
Yeah, and the low dew point pot has only recently invaded, because last week was hot and muggy. And this week's warm, but not so muggy.
But it doesn't seem like much is turning either down here in
that's
southern
true. Yeah, we've seen behind.
Yeah.
Remember earlier we were talking about something we thought was isotropic inversion, but Charlie, who had asked that question, emailed back to say the phenomena they were talking about is called tropospheric ducting.
And so it's a feature in the atmosphere usually associated with temperature differences. And so that waves just kind of stay in there, like that layer in the atmosphere is a duct, and it just keeps it focused in there.
Yeah, and the troposphere extends from the ground to about 10 kilometers. So it's not very deep. It's and it's approximate to the surface. So that's really nice to know where it is kind of happening.
Yeah. And I was thinking about that because remembering that there are times when I was a kid, I used to listen. There was a radio station in Texas I could get.
Oh, right, yeah.
On some occasions, and once in a while, driving in the car in the early morning hours, I would be able to draw in St. Louis or some other city. It was always fun to kind of listen to them, what they were talking about.
Yeah.
So tropospheric ducting. Deb emailed to ask if there is a scientific explanation why dogs feel storms coming. And other animals, to be honest, other animals, cattle and so forth, will respond when there's a storm on the way.
I would think it would be associated with either, I was going to say good hearing, but that's probably not it anymore.
That's what I was going to say.
Oh, you are? Okay.
Yeah,
or
maybe
pressure
changes. You know, they have, dogs have longer snouts, so maybe the pressure is a little bit more noticeable for them. We don't have any snout at all. I mean, but they have these long, long snouts that might react to the pressure disturbances that are in the environment when you have thunderstorms going on. Possible.
Or hearing the sound,
yeah,
the frequency
it was
of lightning or something.
And I was thinking of someone who's done a lot of fishing in his life that oftentimes ahead of a storm, a storm is coming, and the fish, muskies at least, I would have better action just ahead of a storm, and even sometimes during a storm, and right after, nothing.
Yeah, I wonder what that's all about. That's interesting.
It's got to be a pressure.
There is a big pressure change when in that sequence, the pressure's lowering as the storm comes by, probably at its lowest when it's over you, and then higher. That might be the thing for that, but I don't know about dogs. That's interesting. Yeah.
And I don't care how good the fishing is. If there's thunder, there's lightning, and you shouldn't be on the lake.
Yeah, that's right.
And Dean in Evergreen, Colorado, emailed back. He had been on earlier, but he had a comment about losing radio signals. Dean's a ham radio operator. The FM signal is transmitted directly, almost line of sight, and not bounced off the ionosphere. If the person lost the WPR station, it could be due to local interference. That's a typical scenario when receiving radio is marginally receiving the signal from the station to begin with.
That's good to know.
Which is definitely good. And thanks, Dean, for sending that email in. And you could call in or send an email. Give a call at 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. You wrote in your column, the Weather Guy's column that appears in the Wisconsin State Journal, which I always read. You wrote a couple of weeks ago a column about what does the Center for Disease Control have to do with the National Weather Service? And to talk about what that column was about.
Well, we were thinking, that the CDC's been under attack. Its scientific expertise has been under attack by, frankly, conspiracy theorists. And it's not that much of a leap to start imagining a National Weather Service that's, I mean, you know, staffed by people who've forecasting the weather for you and giving you important information who are also conspiracy theorists, you know, chemtrails or whatever it might be. If we let this go too far, this erosion of expertise and this lack of reliance on experts, we'll put ourselves in some really bad spots. And so we were trying to draw some parallel to that so that people don't lose sight of the fact that an assault on any intellectual expertise is an assault on all intellectual expertise with bad consequences for taxpaying, hardworking Americans. Then there's no reason for it.
Well stated.
Thanks.
And people have always questioned the accuracy of weather forecasts. Is public doubt in the National Weather Service really a new issue?
I don't think so. I mean, I think they're always going to want to see a particular weather, and you're not going to remember necessarily all the accurate well forecasts that were done. You're going to remember that one where, you know, your child was having a wedding ceremony.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
It was supposed to be nice. So there's always those human biases that come in. But that's a lot different than conspiracy theories. I mean, there's no evidence of chemtrails. I mean, they just, that's not what they are.
Right.
And we're not doing that intentionally to change the climate. And so there's a difference between disagreement on the scientific outcome of a forecast versus something that's just nonsensical.
Yeah, and it's interesting along these lines, you know, the congressional delegations from all of the states in the South that experience more larger fraction of tornadoes, certainly the largest fraction of hurricanes, they're not anti-Weather Service. They are not anti-Weather Service. And so the Weather Service is a well-respected scientific institution. I think we were just kind of saying we have to be careful not to let that the tide come in on that skepticism, because it'll be really bad news. And we already have at least some people who are elected officials letting ridiculous statements go without challenging them. How much farther can we push that is the question. We got to be careful.
And our weather forecasting has been improving.
Yeah.
I mean, the accuracy of a five-day forecast is, what, a week? Several years ago?
Yeah.
So it's improving.
There's
and
no
it always
question.
Will, provided we have the observations and the scientific expertise and the computer infrastructure to do those simulations.
Yeah, that's right. It keeps getting better. This is an enterprise that never takes a step back.
Yeah.
And, you know, it would be foolish to start to implement changes that would force a step back. We got to be careful of that.
Yeah. You mentioned tornadoes just in passing, and it reminded me that we had a very active tornado season in Wisconsin this year. I think it might have been the sixth highest.
The sixth highest?
Since 1950.
Wow, really? That could be. You know, we had
39 confirmed.
Oh, so that's almost twice what we typically
get. Yeah, that's amazing. That number sounds familiar from the state climatologist update we got a couple of weeks ago, but I didn't remember the ranking. So that's probably right on target.
So
amazing.
And that's a 75-year span, and the sixth highest. And I think we had one day, July 16th, I think we had four pretty good ones. On the same day.
Yeah, wow, that's amazing. And probably, was it the northern part of the state that had them more frequently than the southern part? I think that that was convective activity was up there a little bit more frequently than down here. Wow.
And there was also the tornado alleys have moved a little bit as well, so that, I mean, everything east of the Rockies, it's now kind of a tornado alley, and it seems as though we're seeing many more tornadoes in the south than, you know, along the east coast even than we had before. Maybe not, but...
Well, you're right about that the tornado alley moving slightly east from what it was in the 50s to the 80s. Victor Gensini down at Northern Illinois University has done work on that, and they've definitely shown that it's moved a little bit to the east. So that's absolutely observed phenomena, and probably increases the risk for a larger population of people to being visited by a tornado.
Do they have a theory of why it's moving?
I can't remember what they say. It's Gensini and Harold Brooks from the Storm Prediction Center in Oklahoma. A really nice study. I forget what they said about that. Yeah. It wasn't so much that the intensity was changing or the total number. It was just that the locations
were moving.
Yeah.
Locations and not were more observers.
It probably would have been the headlining thing, which I don't recall. I don't want to say no, but I don't think it was
they would have been the headlining band, yeah.
And what about Haboobs? Haboob?
Haboobs are dust storms. We had one in we have a couple, I think, not in Wisconsin, but in the southeast Arizona, and there was one this summer.
Yeah.
They're pretty phenomenal.
Yeah.
It's a big dust storm. I mean, if you've seen a picture of a dust storm coming at a city, that's probably a haboob, usually associated with outflow from a thunderstorm or something. I was in one like that in Saudi Arabia many, many years ago.
Oh, is that right?
It's like somebody throwing sand at you for 20 minutes. I mean, it's
an electrical shock danger, isn't it?
Yeah, but you're worried about the
probably
the sand
else.
Particles, you know, tearing the skin off your face as opposed to the electric. But you're right, there is static electricity, as there would be with almost anything moving like that.
Wow, that's amazing.
So you need Wisconsin doesn't have the same kind of...
No, we have the same storms, but you need a surface that's devegetated. And
dry.
Farm fields like that, they're probably not going to be dry, or they're not going to be big enough.
Also,
they don't grind. I mean, when they till a farm field now, you got big clumps of soil in there. It's not like back in the 20s, they used to grind that up even smaller. But part of the reason of not doing that was the Dust Bowl. We learned that's not a good thing to do when you till a field.
Yeah, amazing.
And Gene wonders, what causes lightning?
Static electricity in the storm. So it's when you have a thunderstorm, that's where they occur. You're going to have liquid water droplets and ice crystals. And it's sort of like, I know it's a very simple analogy, but that rubber balloon on the wool sweater generates electric charge. And so as the water droplets interact and brush by the ice particles, you end up getting charge within the storm, so that the charge separation occurs in the thunderstorm, and then the lightning is an attempt to neutralize that.
Mm. And what's the length? Also wants to know, what's the length of a lightning bolt?
That was just validated, 515 miles long.
That's unbelievable.
And it occurred in 2017. So that's how long it took to validate what it was. And that was by the World Meteorological Organization, I think, the validations. But
do you remember where it was? I forget where it happened.
No, I don't.
I thought
remember.
It was in the U.S.
It was in the U.S., but
I don't
remember.
Yeah,
it was in the Midwest someplace. Yeah. Not
Is that what they call a mega flash?
That's what they call a mega flash, And, you know, now that we have improved observations for lightning, both on the ground but in space as well now, they've been able to identify these really big, long lightning
That's
events,
horrifying. Talk about action at a distance. Are
you
kidding me?
550 miles away.
How'd you like to be on the receiving end of that bolt?
No, and, you know, that's one of the safety issues. If you hear thunder roar, go indoors, even if it's blue sky out.
Yeah.
Because those lightning bolts can come out of the top.
They don't care.
And come down.
So they can happen. You can have blue sky above and get
and
struck
a thunderstorm
by lightning.
Nearby and get hit by lightning.
Well, on that happy note,
that's
shocking.
But it's not thundering outside, so we're okay.
Oh, guys, thanks again for being. We'll see you the last Monday of October.
All right,
looking forward to talking about how the colors in Wisconsin were beautiful.
I hope so. Steve Ackerman, a former vice chancellor for research and grad education at UW-Madison, one of our guests today, and John Martin, of course, professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, are weather guys. And they'll be back the last Monday of the month. They do it every month of the year. And thank you for listening today. These and all of our shows are a team effort. Our producers, Clara Kniper, Joel Patnaud, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks again for listening, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.